Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the mega city metropolis of Toronto. I am your host, Eric Anthony, and for this episode, I've lost count what episode this is, but we are in the 150s. We are back on schedule. We took a little bit of a hiatus, but coming back to the show, I'm happy to have a guest that I've been meaning to have for a long time. We finally scheduled it and made it work out. This is a Toronto-owned comic book artist, and unfortunately, a roommate of Shane Herron. We got Christopher Yao on the show. Chris, thanks you for finally coming on the show, and I'm sorry for the long wait that we were trying to get this to come together, but we're doing it.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you very much for having me on there.
This is going to be fun. So, Chris, I like to, like everybody wants to know when we talk to comic book creators, what's your comic book origin? What's your history?
Well, my comic book origin, I think, would be I grew up with comics, I think, starting back in the mid-late 80s, where, funny enough, my father had actually had a couple of comics. He got them as some sort of like, you know, he thought I'd like them, you know, as a kid, just something to read, you know.
But how old were you?
I was about like between 10 and 12, I think, at the time. And I was like, just I loved drawing, and I loved the sort of cartoons of, you know, Saturday morning cartoons. And, you know, my father's Saturday papers that had the daily strips and stuff on them, Dennis and Menace and, you know, Family Circus and all that stuff, and Garfield. And I loved that art and writing was being put out like that, you know, and I really gravitated toward it. And I was trying to come up with little stories myself, you know, in the exact same sort of boxes and, you know, punchlines over three panels, you know, of strip. I would do one, you know, based on themes like Christmas or parents' birthday or something like that. You know, here's the punchline, happy birthday, you know. Trying to be in the same vein as those artists of, you know, like Jim Davis and all that. And when the first actual comic wasn't, like true, like story, it was more, you know, those Marvel Universe, those encyclopedias of characters.
Right.
Yeah.
Like the handbook,
so, the official handbook. Okay. Yeah. So, I had had a volume, the tail end, that, it was like, the W's to the Z, right?
Oh, okay.
So, the first character that I ever tried drawing of any comic, even before Batman, was Vision. I opened it up, and the picture that they had for Vision, I can't remember the artist who did it, but it was a really, really cool picture of him with his arm outstretched. And I think it was like a head-to-toe picture, but for some reason, I tried just drawing from the chest up and with the hand extended.
Like maybe a Buscema?
Yeah, probably. And I tried to do the exact lines, like the inking lines, but I didn't know how, you know, inking to me was just like, oh, this is a thick line, now it's a thin line, but I wasn't mimicking it in the same way. It was really scratchy, but it was a pretty good duplication of it, you know, and my dad thought it was, you know, he thought it was pretty nifty. And it was at that point where he told me that when he was going to medical school, because he was a medical doctor, that during the nights he went to a local high school, Central Tech, and took night school art. And I'm like, so how come you never picked up art or anything like that? He's like, it was just something to do, keep my hands busy.
Right.
Until I had to do, you know, courses and internships and stuff at the hospitals.
Was it good for your dad's, like, dexterity to be able to learn how to draw and have that sort of control?
I think he mentioned that it was a good practice for sort of hand-eye coordination and just like muscle memory and stuff for him.
That's interesting.
Because as I'd see him do random things like, you know, he knew how to darn socks, and he knew how to sew up a turkey at Thanksgiving. He had this thing where he actually could do it one-handed.
Was your dad a surgeon?
He was a surgeon. He was a heart surgeon, actually. He said that it was very much almost like a Zen-like practice, too. He's like, I didn't know it, but it actually sort of calmed things down in his head, because as anyone who's entered the medical field and profession knows, that things can get really stressful and your mind can be racing at miles a minute and you're worrying about 50 different things. And I think he mentioned that doing things like that was not really associated with it, like art, was very monastic, very meditative. Mm. You know, even if it was just for like the hour or so a night that he did the classes, you know, he just felt it's a good way for my mind to calm down, because even if you finish your studies, your medical studies, and your practices, even if you go home from that and you're at home, your mind is still racing. But he found that he took this night class, he would stop thinking about and stop worrying about all these things.
But it kept the muscles activated,
right. but it calmed down his mind, is what I think he passed on. And I found that too, actually. Parents would always say, and instructors be like, Chris is really in the zone when he was doing this picture, or this portrait or whatever. And my mom would say the same thing too. It's like, I could be yelling at you to do stuff and you would just be in the zone. I'd just be like, I'm right there in the paper. I'm totally somewhere else, And it wasn't anything to be rude. I wasn't being standoffish to parents. Right. I was literally just, sorry, I would apologize.
Space. Yeah.
And so I would honestly apologize to parents. I'm like, I'm really sorry, Mom. I didn't mean to not hear you. I was just working on this thing. And then they started noticing that, I had this proclivity to draw a lot and read up on art and stuff. So any opportunity they took from the mid-80s on, they were like, what program could he be a part of? What sort of school setting has the best sort of introduction to art and art and creativity? And so...
So they were supportive.
They were very supportive.
That's good.
My dad wasn't, he didn't exclaim it on the rooftops. His advice to me was... I'm not expecting you to do exactly as I do. Every one of you kids is going to do whatever you want to do. But all I hope is that you'll give it absolutely everything you have and not, just do it for the sake of doing something. You have to really be invested in it, And so it wasn't so much like sort of him pointing a finger and being like, pressuring you into, you better work your butt off. He's like, if you love something enough, you're going to gravitate towards it. You're going to work as hard as you can. And I think he saw that with me, with the art. So it was a lot of like, good. But it wasn't, hand you a cookie every time you did a drawing sort
of
thing.
Right.
It was just sort of him sort of backing off. But at the same time, he didn't make you feel that you had to prove something to him, He was just reminding you, it's like, if you love doing this, you're going to pursue it. And sure enough, through grade school, through junior high, senior high, and then into college, I just never let it go. And it was written, I had to, this was the path I had to take. And it wasn't super easy. I always sort of stuck with it because there was always something there that kept me, kept that boat afloat, And I looked around at my other siblings at one point, during my, preteen years and be like, how come they're not doing art and stuff? I guess this is my thing, So at the same time, it kind of made you gave you that individuality,
right.
You know?
This because, is my thing.
Yeah, because I came from a large family, or come from a large family. There are 10 of us.
Wow.
Yeah. So there were five other brothers and four other sisters. And none
Where
of them...
Where did you fit in?
I fit in towards the top. I was the fourth. I popped out as the fourth.
You're the fourth. Okay.
So I was, you know, growing up, born in the 70s, early 70s. The comics and stuff that I was exposed to without being super, super interested in it were things like, you know, Kurt Swan, Superman and stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, so that was just like, you know... don't want to say subliminally sort of injected into my mind, you know, as like a comic interest. But I loved, you know, those Superman comics, you know, those Batmans of the late 70s.
Okay, the Bronze Age.
Yeah, the Bronze Age stuff.
Yep.
And then, you know, the cartoons and stuff that they tried to introduce in the 60s and stuff, like the Spider-Man when they ran syndication stuff. So I'm like, I'm all over this. I love it. But I didn't know that I would gravitate towards it so heavily, you know, until like the 80s. I'm like, man, I really want to make my own stories and stuff. But I always felt like, yeah, Superman's been done. Yeah, Batman's been done. X-Men's been done. Did it? And you try to come up with your own stuff.
So you already had that thing of like, I got to come up with my own.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't just do everyone. This guy's already Batman or Superman is Chris
They've
Swan's.
Already done such a good job.
Right,
you know?
Yeah, you're not going to top
yeah.
that.
Yeah. So what I did was, I would come up with, like, a character, right? You know, draw them head to toe. And then I would do, like, one or two panels of it would just be, like, in the middle of a story that was in my head, where I wouldn't draw the beginning, middle, and end for some reason. I would just want to drop into the action of a scene, right? And because I didn't know the proper sort of storytelling. But
right.
At the same time, it was, I want to... You know, I want people to get to know this character. So I would do, like, yeah, little panels once in a while. And it wasn't until high school and late high school where I'm like, no, I really need to actually put a full... Hey, I want to put a full comic together. How many pages is it? How many panels on a page, you know? And I think that's where I sort of started self-teaching the storytelling part of it. Recently, in the past, like, 5-6 years, I was told that I'm really good at storytelling. Like, I have a sort of inclination towards it, and it makes me think back to late high school, where I'm like, I really, really was passionate about wanting to tell a story, so I was trying to find a way through reading those books from Image and the Detective Comics annuals and stuff, just seeing how they told the story. There were certain series from DC and Marvel that I was attached to as well, like you know, a certain Spider-Man storyline or a certain Batman collection of books. How would they do those 4-book series, like the cult that was done, like Bernie Wrightson?
Love that
series. I'm so glad they still have it. But I read that thing like dozens of times because I just loved how the atmosphere was set, how Bernie set the atmosphere, and just how the characters interacted with each other, expressions on faces, you know, and the action, but how everything sort of the you know, ebb and flow of the story, you know, rises and it's very, very unique.
Stood out at that time. I mean, there was a lot of things happening then where. Especially Batman was a little bit more cutting edge, but that one, there's the way it was painted and drawn.
Exactly.
It's got an atmosphere. Who wrote that again?
Oh man, I am trying to remember.
Was it Mike Barr?
I'm not exactly sure. I'd have to go back and
I feel like
look
he's bothered,
at it.
Like Jim Starlin, Mike Barr. I don't remember somewhere one of those guys.
Yeah,
yeah.
But it was just a fascinating story, and it was one of them that you really sort of. Connected to the antagonists as well, you know. I mean, like, yeah, Batman was there, and he's like, he's gonna do his thing, but then the other character, that preacher character, you're like, for some reason, I'm just really engaged in what he's saying and what his mindset is in the story, and I think that that was one of the major influential Batman stories. that sort of like got me well into wanting to, you know, storytell and do my own comics and stuff. You know, other ones were like, you know, the Dan Jurgens Superman versus Doomsday. The Mark Waid Alex Ross Kingdom Come. That's another one. Mm-hmm. Just like all these ones that I was reading cover to cover, and again and again. You know, I mean that there was a reason behind it, and
like those, you like those definite series. Like
the it was a series that
had a four-issue arc, mm-hmm. and you get a complete story in this. It wasn't like continued in adventures of whatever.
Exactly. And I think that's where my sort of interest in collecting waned was. It was like, what, mid-90s, when they would like things like Image, Wildstorm, and Extreme Studios and stuff. They were just crossing over each other. It looked like this crazy, you know, crazy map of a conspiracy theory. It's like, you have to go to this issue, two issues in, and then you have to bounce over to this.
That's fun other just for a little bit.
It is. It is.
For a little bit. And then it gets to the point where it's like, I got all this crap that I don't want.
And it was true. It's like, I have to collect this title that I'm really not invested in. You know, I mean, bless Rob Liefeld and the guys at Extreme at the time, but I just was not... Like, I didn't want to pick up the title. I didn't want to pick up, you know, those books. But you had to, because you had to see where this storyline with these characters went. And it just became too much for me. So I'm like, you know what? I'm going to focus on trying to do my own story, you know? Mm. And that's where I found myself sort of spending more time doing my own artwork. And, yeah, still going to the local shops and you know, reading some of the books on the rack, picking up a trade. That's where I started getting into the trade paperbacks themselves, mm-hmm. you know. But at the end of it, I think it was just I was more in tune with getting my own story set up. It's actually, like, first, second year of college, which was, like, late 90s, 95, 96, in 97, where I came up with a title called Fonkin, which was about a little cybernetic boy and his adventures through this, like, just kind of generic post-apocalyptic type city and world.
When was this? What year?
This was 96 that I came up with it.
Okay.
And I'd have a journal that I'd, like, drew up the characters, and I drew it in a way that was a definite departure from how I was trying to draw, like, superhero comics. It was a very unique style, and I don't know what prompted me to sort of draw the character like that. It was very organic and very, you know, simple.
Mm.
So I drew the character, I drew the supporting characters, I made up, you know, the sort of background. What's his origin? If he has a family, what's the planet that he's on? What's the situation that he's brought into? I had the pages and pages of it. And then I would draw little snippets of his adventure where he interacts with another character. And I'd drawn that up, but not really drawn the full comics. I'd done like 15 pages, but it sort of like petered out. I don't know what prompted that, but it took a backseat, and I was still drawing, but not as, you know, not as much in comics as much as, like I had to do freelance design work. I had to, you know,
so that was your day job.
That was the day job, was doing the freelance design and the comics had to sort of sit back. But eventually, I crossed paths with, someone out in Oakville, and, they wanted to do a thing of comics, a line of comics, a little sort of publishing label. And they saw that I was doing, you know, my own book, and they wanted to say, let's do this teamwork thing. Let's do a series of comics. We'll do your comic, and then we'll do this other guy who's interested, and then we'll do, I have an idea, right? But little did I know that I had to draw all three.
Oh.
So I had one drawn in my style, which was that unique, weird... Mm-hmm.
For Fonkin.
For Fonkin. And then I had the second title. I can't remember. I think it was like called Fast Forward Magic or something. I think I might still have the artwork from it. But that one was drawn more in a... more of a traditional comic type style. And then the third book was this goofy, pretty cartoony styling comic about martial arts animals. And so I'd spent that one summer doing all three books. Like, just every day I'd go out to Oakville into this, like, studio space, and I would draw... you know, a page of each comic. And so I'd be doing three pages a day. And I was just like, I'd get there at like 8:30. And then I'd, finish up at like 6 or 7 or something at night. And I was just, my hands were cramping and stuff. But I loved doing it. It's like, oh my gosh, someone's actually paying me. It was virtually pennies.
But you felt like you were...
I was accomplishing this great thing. And I had... I'm like, we're gonna publish these. I'm actually gonna have a physical comic of my work.
Yeah.
You know, my hands. I'd never experienced that before. And but unfortunately, we did get proof copies done, but we never went to full print with all the books, right? It just the situation fell flat. And that was around like 2000, 2001 or something. And because the guy, he wanted to actually buy my idea of Fonkin right from under me. He's like, no, I thought what I was paying for, those pennies, was to buy your idea. I'm like, no, that's not how it works.
Yeah, that's my property.
Because he had a different idea of how sort of comic properties work. And so that sort of burned a bridge there. So I took Fonkin and I just, went home and didn't really... And I was kind of soured on the idea. I'm like, man, I'm really disillusioned on how this works, but it was like 2002 where I went to, I think, then the Paradise comic show.
Okay,
and
yeah.
That's where I met Ty Templeton first time.
Okay.
And I actually showed him, like, this is the sort of stuff that I was working on. This is the last sort of book thing that I was working on. And he's like, oh, okay. I mean, and he was... giving me good feedback about storytelling and he was really truly sort of interested in how I got to where I was, with this comic and doing comics in general.
Yeah.
And
had you had any formal training? Or
I had
all
none.
Self-taught?
I had self-taught because I just really loved wanting to do comics and I really wanted to figure out a way to do it. But, the closest I had come to, tasting formal training was actually in, I think it was like 97, I went to New York. And I went to New York Comic Con, and guess who I met? Joe Kubert.
Wow.
I sat down with that guy for like half an hour, 45 minutes. And I had done, I didn't know I was going to actually talk to him, but I had drawn up 4 pages of just I made up a Batman story. 2 burglars break in, and they're trying to steal a jewel, and Batman swoops in and just takes them down. And actually, I think I remember the pages not being quite finished at the end, but I'm like, this is the most finished sort of pencil work. And they were just pencils. I didn't ink them at all. And I took them, and there was Joe Kubert. So I'm like, I guess I'm talking to this guy. And then, like, because I saw, like, his, yeah, he'd have like Sergeant Rock and stuff out. Yeah. I'm like, holy God, it's Joe Kubert, because I'd never really seen his face. And it was, I remember it just being very relaxed, and he was very attentive, and he answered all my questions and was very patient. And he was starting, he was doing the school at the time, like just pitching the school. And I'm like, I'd really love to get more information about it. So we, the rep took information, sent me a package after I'd gotten back to Toronto. And I remember just looking at that package and being heartbroken that I couldn't afford to take the courses.
Because that's the course of courses.
Yeah, and you had to go to New York State to take it. And I'm like, I can't.
Yeah,
you know?
You gotta uproot your whole life.
Exactly. And yeah. I mean, I was fresh out of high school. I was just going through college. And I'm like, I really wish I could. But I think if anything, it pushed me. Having talked to someone like Joe Kubert, I think it gave me that extra push to say, like, you stick with the comics. Stick with trying to be as good a comic artist as you want to be, right? And I think that I kept drawing all the time. Doing my freelance work, I'd always inject a bit more sort of comic book sensibility to it. And I think that's where I started developing a style that was... It was very... rough, but you could tell that I just really wanted to get better at it.
There's that saying, right? 10,000 hours of practice, you become expert.
Yeah, and I think but the 10,000 hours spread over so many years,
right,
because
right.
it was ebbs and flows where...
A little bit of this, a little bit of that.
Yeah, and I'd get their moments of, at the time, a lot of tired discouragement. From it, I'm like, I don't want to do it. I can't. Obviously can't, you know, but I wasn't understanding the mindset of, you know, I mean, this is, you can always get better. You know, you're never going to peak. And if you peak, you're doing something wrong.
You never want to be that guy who peaks.
Exactly. I mean, you never want to sit there one day, wake up and say, that work there on the table, that's the best I'm going to do. There is no way I'm going to exceed that. And that's where... You know, that's where I feel like you're lost, you know, because you've tricked your mind into saying that there's no more adventure to go on. There's no more.
It's almost like no more life to live.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And you may be seeing things a certain way, but you're not seeing it through other people's eyes. And it's really hard to, you have to try and pull yourself out once in a while. And get a fresh perspective on things, you know.
So who were some of those people when you were growing up during like that time where you really realized, I want to... Like, who were those artists or those writers that said, I want to make my own? Mm-hmm. What was that stuff that you kind of was a crash course of storytellers?
I would say the mid-late 90s where I was really getting into it, you know, Jim Lee's work and Mark Waid's writing. And it was just, I was right into it because the way they would personify characters really had me invested. Like, I really cared what happened to the character from the moment they sort of were introduced in the first couple of pages to right up to the end. You know,
so what do you think it is about Jim Lee's art? Because a lot of people hold him in that spot of high regard. But amongst his class, like you think of the Image 7, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What separates him and his style? Because there's a certain aesthetic that you can see is definitely of an era, the McFarlane, the Liefeld, the way the characters look. It feels like this is them.
Yeah.
What was it about him, though, that people don't criticize as much?
I think that his ability to make the most heroically statuesque, you know, characters, any character that he draws, he can draw, I think, as being, there's an element of simplicity to it, but there's just such a presence of power in every part of the body that he draws, you know? And I was always fascinated from, it's like, how he draws fists and how he draws his faces, you know? And just how he stands them up, you know? And how he engages them in any form of action. And I remember, if you remember Wizard Magazine, right? How they'd have, one of my favorite parts was the how-to with XYZ.
Right, right.
And I'd taken the pages of Jim Lee's interview and how-tos out, put them on my wall, you know, I'm like, until they yellowed and fell apart. And I'd done that with a few other artists, like J. Scott Campbell had one, and Rob Liefeld, you know, as well. I'm not going to say that Rob Liefeld wasn't an influence as well. In my early, like, really cruddy work, you can kind of see that I was trying to sort of get that.
There's a dynamic thing
he
to
has
those
a
stuff,
very,
right?
Jim and Rob had, and especially Todd McFarlane, they all had like an amazingly dynamic style, you know, and it just, they pushed out so much energy, and they were just throwing so much, you know, lights and dazzle at you, you know. But I think that out of all of them, the way that Jim Lee sort of, you know, he gave like a cool, calm but powerful presence to characters and storytelling.
Sort of control.
It wasn't like he wouldn't go completely bonkers with you know, with the scene or with the characters.
Yeah, the anatomy wasn't ridiculous.
It wasn't.
But it was still strong. They were like wrestlers.
Yeah, and it was like very, it was super, super signature. You know? I mean, you could tell, like, if it was just a headshot.
Yeah.
It's Jim Lee. Jim Lee's headshot. And even things like, you know, torso. If I just see a torso drawn, I'm like, yeah, Jim Lee did that torso, you know, or the hand or whatever. So definitely, you know, between those three, Jim Lee, J. Scott Campbell, and Rob Liefeld, those I think would be the three artists with Jim at the top who really, really influenced me to sort of work harder at you know,
trying craft.
To, yeah, at the craft and storytelling, character creation, action, all that, you know. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm really fascinated to look at them now when they're, you know, they bring them back, like when Jim Lee comes back to do Batman, you know, and is like Kobo Butcher or Rob Liefeld, they, you know, they get
Young
him
blood
on,
or on a yeah. Deadpool. Yeah.
You know, I mean, how he did like the Hawk and Dove and stuff before,
yeah.
And then they brought him back to do, you know, and I'm like sitting there looking at both and seeing like, okay, how did he evolve? And that's another interesting facet too, is that being a kid who grew up in the 80s, 90s, you know, and you were influenced by these artists in the 90s, and then you just watch like how they changed and how they kept their signature look or evolved it, you know? And I was hoping that I would go through the same sort of process. And I think that was another mindset that I gladly took on. You know, it's like, if nothing else, I want to see how I evolve, you know? I'm always going to learn and hopefully get better, you know, for myself and for others. And I feel like I've seen that evolution, you know? I mean, I'll go back and see these one or two sketchbooks that I kept from the 90s, and I'll cringe at it.
But
at the same time, it is.
That's good.
It is. And I'm always, and I've always sort of rooted for those artists who influenced me. I haven't seen as much from people like J. Scott Campbell as of late.
He's more of that cover.
He's done more of the cover and he's like done calendars and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, it's great to see them still there,
right?
You know, and be proud of all the work that they've done. And you hope that you could be half the sort of artist or creator that they are, you know? Mm. But I think, if nothing else, just adopting a mindset of sticking with it, you know, instead of just seeing, you know, like with social media, I feel like it's very easy for you to go on to a social media feed, whether it's Facebook or Instagram or whatnot, and look at other creators, and they're just, you know, they're obviously going to work at a different pace than you, you know, or in a different sort of process, you know. And it would be very easy for you to look at it and be like, well, my stuff sucks compared to them, or I'm not working as hard as they are. They're putting out so much better stuff so much quicker. And
which is subjective.
It's very subjective. And I think that you have to sort of, and I think I almost fell into it where I would look at other creators and be like, well, I'm just not going to be as good as that, or I'm just not going to be as prolific as that.
Nah, you know? Why bother?
And then, yeah, and it's very easily, you could fall into a hole. And I've seen some creators who go, well, I'm not going to do this then because it's just going to suck. I'm not going to work on this because I'm not going to get it done on time. I think that you have to use social media in a very, very methodical, careful manner.
You should watch or follow things that are going to inspire you, exactly, as opposed to make you...
Exactly. They're not going to pull you down,
right,
internally.
Right.
So that's what I switch gears with, made sure that I'm going to be influenced and be inspired to, when I finish looking at that, I'm going to go over to that table and I'm going to work for as long as I feel like working, you know? And if you could put a bit of that, the
love.
More you do it,
yeah,
the more you do it and the more you're in tune with doing it, you know, the more your style and your, you know, and your stories are going to evolve. And I feel like I've come a long way, and hopefully have a long way to go, you know?
That's a good attitude.
Yeah.
As an artist, because you mentioned that thing of like, you see other people, I'll never be that good, or why bother, I'm not going to make that deadline. Do you notice in other artists' work, like, ooh, that's not looking too good, or that's they messed up there? Because I feel like artists notice that about their stuff very clearly, and they can't live with it. But do you notice that about other people?
Well, initially, no. Initially, when I did get on social media and I would see all these other artists that had amazing work, I'm like, this person cannot do any wrong. But as soon as you sort of switch your mindset to being not as much intimidated by the artist as trying to they're your peer, you know,
being
with them on this journey as well. It's like they're your brother in arms in comics. Then you start to notice,
Human.
They're human, and you're like, hey, I do that too. And you're not going to sit there and point it out to them like, your hands have been crappy lately. I'll notice things like, yeah, they did this. They really did a good job on this, and I noticed that they did this other part kind of. You know, they did it in a way that didn't seem quite as polished, you know, but it's not like, you don't feel like that's ammunition to be like, haha, so I did mine.
Yeah, I make better fists than you.
What I immediately feel like is like, man, I totally understand how that is because I'm always going to have days where I feel like I've drawn the crappiest thing ever, you know, and it's just, I throw it out, you know, even though you'll be sitting with someone going, what are you doing? Why are you throwing that out? And I'm like, because I didn't do the best job that I could. I can do better, you know? The trick is not to get mired in it. Being like, I did it again. I crapped the bed again. I can't pull this off. There's practice.
That's good for a week.
It is.
That's good for a week, and then you gotta get over it. It's like an athlete who's you know, not hitting their shots.
Exactly.
Or, you know, goalie not making the saves. You just gotta say, okay, I had a bad week. It's gonna, because you have the skill. You haven't lost that skill.
Exactly. Because you'll look at, I'll keep sketchbooks, and I'll look back and be like, no, I pulled this off.
Yeah,
you can. You know, I did this thing. I know how to do it.
Exactly.
It's just a matter of, you know, I mean, you can get back to it again. It's like riding a bike, you know, but some artists will be like, you know, like a full month where they're in a funk, and everybody's allowed to be in a funk. I'm not going to say that they're not. But I think that it's a real proof of character that you can pull yourself up and continue back learning and pushing yourself.
Yeah, there's those, you know? Two. I've read that there's two levels of like entitlement of people who think they deserve because they're good or whatever.
Yeah.
But then there's the other half of entitlement where nothing's good for me. I'm no good.
Yeah,
because it's almost like you're trying, that funk is, you're trying to gain attention or something from it. Like,
exactly.
It's not getting you anywhere.
Yeah, and you don't want people. One of the last things I ever wanted was people patting me on the back, being like, it's okay, you're a great artist.
Yeah.
And then, you know, just babbling in your ear, you're like giving you reinforcement.
If you're looking for that validation from people all the time,
You're actually not going to produce.
No.
There was a period where, I mean, it happens the most with, bless them, my own family, where they're like, you're really good. Why are you so hard on yourself? My mom was terrible about that because they're your mother, you know? I mean, they're going to always, they're never going to say your shit.
Yeah.
You really got to pick up your game, okay? Everything that I did, I would throw things away and she would get physically angry. She'd be like, I can't believe you just threw that out. And I'm like,
It's a balance, right?
And she eventually became understanding about it. But I felt like there was a point where all there was as an audience was her, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I feel like part of my mindset at the time was like, oh, well, then I'm good. I'm good. Anything I do is good.
Mom says,
you know,
I'm good.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. You know, and swift kick in the butt when, you know, the internet became, you know, such a huge presence that you're like posting your stuff online for the first time and you're receiving that criticism and it's fucking crushing. It crushes you. But at the same time, you're like, but my mom likes it.
Yeah.
Somebody out there likes it, you know?
Absolutely.
So that's where I felt like I almost slipped into that sort of mire of like, well, I should just give up on art. But at the same time, it was somebody likes it, even if it's just my mother. But at the same time, the person who criticized the work doesn't have a face or a proper name, right? You know, because they would just be an avatar online. You don't know where this person lives.
Some people, that's their entertainment.
Exactly.
Yeah, to be negative is their entertainment.
Exactly.
Sad, but.
And unfortunately, there are going to be creators who just can't break through. When they get that one criticism, they wear it like a badge, you know? And I've seen a few fellow creators, you know, who just walk away. They just walk away from it. And I'm like, why? And you don't want to badger them to get back into it. What they want to do is what they want to do. But to just be so affected so quickly, so easily by one comment, you know?
Not everybody's supposed to like your art.
Exactly.
Right?
And that's a hard lesson to learn.
Yeah.
But once you do learn it, I think you're definitely stronger for it.
Yeah,
you know? So...
So, did you grow up with all your 10 siblings? I want to ask you about that. What was that like growing up with 10 siblings?
You know what? I mean, it was kind of whirlwindish because of the number of us and because I guess this sort of strain it presented to my mother and my dad working all the time, right?
Yeah.
We had my aunt and uncle who lived at the time like a couple of blocks away from us in North York. So
you grew up in Toronto?
I grew up in Toronto, okay. Born and raised.
Okay.
And our first family home was in North York. And so my dad, you know, my mom and dad had helped bring my dad's sister and her husband and her few kids over.
Whereabouts in North York?
It was York Mills and Bayview.
Okay.
Around there.
I grew up in North York too, so
yeah,
I
yeah.
think.
Yeah. Not far from the Don Mills Center.
Right.
Banbury Road, I think it was. So my aunt and uncle were more than happy to help take care of us, you know, when it was just too much because the more of us were popping out like throughout the 70s. My mom had plentifully recalled how it was just a blur. The 70s to the early 80s were just a blur for her. Just so many, like every other year was a kid coming. And it was interesting when you became fully cognizant of like, oh my God, all these guys are my brothers and sisters and stuff, you know, and how there would be sort of certain... I mean, a large enough clan of us that there would be cliques
of
people, you know? It's like my oldest brother and oldest sister were just hanging out together. Or, the youngest sister and the second youngest brother would hang out and stuff like that. It was really interesting. But where it was really mind-blowing, I think, was, obviously Christmases and stuff like that, you know? where you really got the sense of scale.
That must have been fun.
Yeah, it was. It was a hoot. I'd been going through old family pictures of the last year and a half, just seeing like Christmases in like 1985, where there would just be like this 12-foot tree. And just like you couldn't see the floor because there was just wrapping paper everywhere. And it was not just our family. My aunt's family had eight kids there. So it was like we had eight cousins. And then, yeah, it was just it always felt like this grand affair of family. Definitely at Christmas, at New Year's, at Thanksgiving. Easter, not really, you know. New Year's, a couple of cousins and stuff would come over. There was one point where we had moved to this big house in Rosedale, and it was three floors and 16 rooms, and everyone had their own room, and it was, It was like the Sound of Music, kind of, you know. That's but funny. We weren't all wearing the same outfit, you know. It was very at times chaotic.
Sure,
I bet. As we all started going through, you know, junior high, senior high, and stuff, we all wanted to be. It's not cool to hang out with your brother, man. But at the same time, you really appreciated them, and I still do to this day. You had that much of like family love, you know. So I think that. You hear stories of people like, God, why these people have like so many kids? They come here and have so many kids. But I think that our family is one of the situations that had like we weren't like an annoyingly, you know,
large
like
family.
Annoyingly large chipper family, you know, that did everything together.
Right.
But we were when we did. Have like a connected sort of family situation, it really meant something, you know. And I think if I had to do it all over again, I mean, I'd have it play out the same way, you know.
Sure.
So yeah, with the same amount of them, you know.
Yeah,
I've had people ask like, do you think that what would be different if it was you or had been the youngest kid, if there were only like four of you? And I'm like, I could never.
Those what ifs, those hypotheticals. Yeah. It's like, but I'm not. I'm the fourth.
Exactly. There's I'm six the fourth. There's six
after
that
you know, they're my siblings.
Exactly. You know, and I couldn't be more fortunate or happy.
Sure.
You know, so yeah, it's great. You know, and
that's so nice that you are able to like see that and appreciate as big as it is, because people, you know. Bigger families, bigger drama, this, mm-hmm. that. But you to have that sort of like, I wouldn't change it for anything.
Yeah.
That your parents did something.
Yeah, we all had ups and downs.
You're supposed to.
Exactly.
That's experience.
Exactly. And that all makes us individual. We aren't all mindless drones.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I think the most fascinating part was when that first sibling started, you know, got married, had kids, and we're like, here we go.
Yeah,
and sure enough,
now it's coming.
My dad eventually was grandfather to 14 grandkids.
Any great grandkids?
No great grandkids. He had a hoot with all of them, you
That's
know?
Good.
I mean, he just like his face would light up every time
That's
they'd
good.
Come over. And he you know, in his older years, he would still want to, like, take him for ice cream or take him to Riverdale Farm. You know, he'd say, oh, they all love the farm.
Was he expecting more grandkids since there were 10 children?
Well, I never got the sense that I was, and neither from my mother, I never got the sense that I was being pressured. Mm. He'd be like, look at your sister. She's gotten married, had kids. What's going on with you? You know? They were both always very just like, you know, you're living mm-hmm. your life,
yeah.
And you're not, you're not in financial trouble. You're not in trouble with the law. You're not messed up with drugs.
We don't
got to
worry about
you, know?
You.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, whatever you want to do, you know, I mean, we're It's totally cool. We still love you.
People ask about, hey, how's Chris? He's doing good.
Yeah, exactly. Right? There's not a whole big story and stuff behind it. It's like, what, you mean the non-childbearing sibling?
Yeah.
You know? But I have been, you know, I mean, I'm the cool uncle.
Right.
You know?
The guy makes comics.
Yeah. And which is, I feel, you know, I mean, pulling back into comics, I feel, well, my sister said that I am now officially an influence on a couple of my nephews who want to do comics.
That's awesome.
So they're over in England, but they're on that, what is it, the WhatsApp?
Okay.
And they'll jump on and they'll message me. They'll be like, Uncle Chris, check this out. And they'll send me a picture that they drew of Spider-Man or something like that. And I'm like, fantastic work. You know, I mean, I can tell that they're just really love doing it. And to have, you know, my sister say, you know what? I mean, if you hadn't sat down with them and, you know, enjoyed creative drawing time when they come and visit, you know, I don't think they would have.
And sometimes you never know, like, we all have our aspirations of being the one to make it big, but you might be the one to push that person,
which
is just as rewarding.
Exactly. But I'm not going to be like, you know, dance moms or, where I'm like, you better bring it your all or you might as well go home.
Yeah.
Your mom will be very disappointed. I have been nothing but absolutely supportive in what they want to do. Like one of my nieces, she draws little comic strips, right? And I didn't notice she was doing this until like a couple of years ago. I went over for a birthday party and I looked on the fridge and I'm like, who did this? And she's like, oh, Lily did this. And I'm like, that's amazing. Like that she not only just wanted to draw, but she's like come up with her own stories. I'm like, how often does she do this? And my sister's was like, she does it. She draws something like every other day. And it's because you've sat there and drawn with her. And I've, you know, any time nieces or nephews, that was my thing. It's like, hey, who wants a picture sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
So it's gone from them wanting me to draw pictures to
show me how
to do it. And sure enough, now they're getting older. They're getting on social media, you know, and they're sending me photos of drawings that they've done, you know. And I'm like,
That's so a priceless awesome. Thing, though, because
it really is.
Because there's nothing, I think, more fulfilling for people when they learn how to create something. Like, there's something that it does in your brain.
Yeah.
So if you can pass that on to them, they'll always be grateful for that.
Yeah, yeah. I feel, too, that I fortunately got prepared for those moments when I was working at the Comic Book Lounge in Gallery.
Yeah, tell me about that.
Well, I mean, I'd gone there as, you know, I mean, part of the, you know, the comic book community that was, you know, just very vibrant at the time. And it was after I took Ty Templeman's comic book boot camp.
So how did you get to the boot camp? I heard there's an interesting story about that.
The boot camp was after I had met Ty at the Paradise Comic Show. I had, like, you know, gone back and worked on some comic stuff. And then I'd seen him again at, I think it was one of the Fan Expo shows. And he was doing his early days of the comic book boot camp. And I'm like, how do I really want to get in on this, but I can't afford to, you know, at the time. But he had just, you know, given me the rundown, and he's like, this is how it goes. It's like one day a week and whatever. I'm like, I really want to try and get in on this. This is awesome. This is exactly what I wanted. You know, because I'd been self-teaching myself for so many years, and here it is, an official sort of course that I could take, you know, because I never got to take that Joe Kubert course, you know? So in 2010, I was coming off a job out in Mississauga, and I was living out in Mississauga at the time, and I'd lost that job, but I was collecting EI at the time, and I'm like, what do I do? You know, I guess I go back to freelance stuff. And but my girlfriend at the time is like, you've been talking about this boot camp course. Take that at EI. Take the course. You have more than enough coming in for this. So I'm like, why am I not doing this right now? So I contacted Ty, and I was like, I really want to take this course. I feel like now's the time to do it. So, you know, I put in for the first round of classes, you know, and the first class was at Bloor Street Church at, I think it was Spadina, is like Bloor Street United Church, and it was like the top floor in like a small sort of side room in like an attic part. And he was like, sorry about the small space and whatever, if you can't see or whatever. And at that moment I was like, there's absolutely nowhere else I'm supposed to be right now than here doing this. And at that moment, and from that moment on, I was just transfixed with everything he had to say. I brought a binder. I was like taking mad notes on everything he was talking about, you know, and, I was just soaking it all up, you know, and I was like, this is the journey I need to be on. So I took the first round of courses, and then he introduced the second part. And on the second part, he introduced that he was going to do an anthology about the descendants of Sherlock Holmes and Watson. Called Holmes Incorporated. He was like, I'm going to do an anthology series, and we're going to use you guys, the students, as the creators on this, right? So he came up with the story Bible and stuff, his idea. And then he had, he did a whole round table at the end of the second part of the boot camp. And he's like, okay, we're going to pair you off, one writer to one artist. If you have a particular person you want to work with, let me know, da-da-da. And so we eventually got paired off, and we started. He planned it out to be as professional an environment, editorial production environment of a comic, you know, to get that experience. And I'm like, this is fantastic. This is exactly what I need. I really, if nothing else, I need to know how the process worked, right?
Right.
And there were so many things that I had no clue. It's like, I did not know that you actually had to do this step before you did it. I thought you just went to here and mm-hmm. whatever. And he's like, silly rabbit. So I was just firmly entrenched into it, and I was nervous. It was like, you know, when you get that first day of school jitters, and your stomach's turning, and you're like,
am I going to pass this year?
Exactly. And so we had every production meeting, it was once a week, and he'd be like, okay, this week, you as the artist need to bring in this. I'm like, yes, sir, you know? And every week, my palms would be sweaty. I'd be like, I hope I really did this right. And I just made sure I was putting my best foot forward, because I was treating it not just like, cool meetup class.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I was treating it like,
serious.
Yeah, like Ty was DC to me or Marvel to me. And I'm like, oh my God, I gotta do this right. And I would sit there and like, you'd have to present it in front of the group, right? And I'm like, here are my layout pages. And he's like, why are you shaking? This is some of the best stuff I've seen, you know? I mean, You really know that you want to be here, you know? I mean, there's that's where I got a sense of, like, people who really want to do it, and then other people who were just passing the time. They're like, I don't know, people said doing comic stuff was cool, mm-hmm. you know? But I was, like, dead set on doing the best job that I could.
You respected the craft.
Exactly, right. You know? We went through the whole process through however many weeks until every story was done. And then ready, and then we'd have like he's like, the stories are finished. You guys did a great job. Let's send it off to the printer. I'm like, it's like, we're gonna get this in print, and we're gonna take it to Fan Expo. And I'm like, at the same time, I was working on, I had had that Fonkin story that I was talking about, and I'm like, you know what? I've learned so much from this course. I want to apply it to this story that I can't get out of my head, the Fonkin story. So I started using, applying all the storytelling and writing lessons that he had given over those number of weeks. And I applied it every day, stayed up so many hours per night working on each page to make sure the script worked and the art worked.
But it probably didn't even feel like work in that sense.
It didn't. It was just like me. Everything's just coming together. Exactly. It was out all my entire world from the beginning when the sun came up till it went down was just that comic.
And it turned out that misfortune of losing a job is what brings you to this point of clarity.
Exactly. Yeah. And it was like, yeah, I could have done better at that job, but I think this happened for a reason. You know, it happened for a reason. You know, everything fell into the way because itself, exactly. Yeah. So I double presented, like I put two loads of pressure on myself to do so good for this Holmes Incorporated book for Ty and the group of the boot camp, but also this book Fonkin, which I had never shown to the public before. I'm like, I like the book. And throughout while we were doing meetings for Holmes Incorporated, I was skeptical at first, but I'm like, I went up to Ty one day and I'm like, I hope this isn't appropriate. I hope this isn't out of place or whatever, but I've been working on my own story. And he's like, what? He's like, how are you able to do this? Like, I thought you were like, you know, he's like, I'm really impressed that you're actually not only just applying everything that you've learned into this Holmes Incorporated, but you are pushing it into your own work as well. I'm like, I really want to see this book. So I would go to him and I'd show him progress pages and ask how story flow is going, get feedback, you know. And I was like, I have to see this. This is the perfect opportunity to do this book. So I'd stay up late nights, you know, but not shirk my responsibilities on getting the Holmes Incorporated stuff done. And by the time Fan Expo 2010 rolled around, again, working with the money that I had, put in for the table, which was so much cheaper then. And it was only 3 days at the time.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm doing this show. I've never tabled by myself at a show. I don't know thing one about how to sort of properly present myself. And all I knew was, like, just don't clutter your table with garbage. You know, don't put up ridiculous setups. Just present only your best work, because thousands and thousands of people are going to be looking at this stuff. And sure enough, I mean, it was a mind-blowing experience, you know, because you showed the book to people, you explained it, you were telling them synopsis and like what the story was about, and they were like, you know what, you really are passionate about this book, and you know, and proud to be a part of Holmes Incorporated. And being at the show was just, I was so dead tired after it. And it wasn't because of just the long hours. It was because here I am, I have so much energy and love for this Fonkin book. But then someone taps me on the shoulder and goes, yeah, you got to go over and represent at the ties at the booth for Comic Book Bootcamp. I'm like, oh my God. So I'm running around, but it's not just, you know, running around getting signatures or any fan stuff. It's like
work.
It's work. I'm like, I'm working, selling myself here and then selling myself here as part of a great group. And, you know, looking back, I mean, I don't know where I'd be if I hadn't, you know, just jumped in.
That's good.
Yeah. Doing the boot camp thing. I think it was a huge life changer for me.
That's great. You know?
Yeah.
And how did that lead into now what you were talking about, the Comic Book Lounge?
Yeah. So what happened was the home for the boot camp needed a different situation. It first started at that church, the Bloor Street Church. And then the following, I decided to take part in it every successive year he held it. I'm like, I'm going to take part two. I'm going to take part three. I'm going to come back and be a part of this every year you take it, as long as I can afford it. And so the second issue took place he had to go down the street to that OISE building, the Ontario Institute, whatever, student, teacher, whatever. And so he had rented out a room, and so we'd done that. And we did the whole same process again, the boot camp and, you know, working out issue two. And then the third issue, and then, he moved midway through that. He found a new space that was at College in Bathurst, but right at the corners, like above a veterinary clinic. So it was like a walk up, and it was like two or three blocks away from eventually what became Comic Book Lounge. But this above this vet clinic. And so it was a small space, but it was a perfect studio space for him to teach his classes and then do, you know, do the meeting and production for the second installment of Holmes Incorporated, and then eventually the third one. And then with the third one, they... At the same time, Kevin Boyd had gone in. I can't remember who he went in with to take over what was Dragon Lady Comics was being sold. So they took all of that and moved it into this space above. I think it was like a pub at the time, and Kev named it the Comic Book Lounge and Gallery. So he had the manager, Joe Kilmartin from Dragon Lady, come along with him, and they set up shop at this walk-up at College in Bathurst. And then Ty came in, you know, proposed being, you know, part of this, you know, part of this environment, because there was a big enough space that Ty could teach his classes and, you know, and it from there, it just became, I was there all the time.
Yeah.
You really saw the community come out of the woodwork, where you had, you know, members of Raid who weren't far away from us come by, and these other sort of Toronto comic pros that just come to this, what eventually was almost like a hub, right? Because you had the comic book shop, the headquarters, you had Ty's boot camp being taught there. You had it was like cartoonist workshop as well, that eventually I got to be teaching kids at the lounge on Saturday mornings, and then Kevin kept me on. He's like, hey, you're here all the time, do you want to help out with, you know, store operations, like receiving stock and, you know, and stuff like that. And I'm like, boy, howdy. And it was a hoot, because I was, you know, they dubbed me artist in residence, because I was there teaching and then doing receiving stock. And I just stick around. Kevin's like, if you want to stick around and draw, I'll just have you in as artist in residence. So I just sit there and work on my pages, work on Fonkin, work on, you know, commissions for people. At the time, those blank sketch covers were coming into popular. So Kevin's part of his stock was getting X amount of issue to get this sketch cover variant. And he gets so many of them. And every week I'd be like, put one of each aside for me. And I was drawing them like mad. And so, like, in a week, I was drawing maybe 10 or 15 covers. And then I started putting them up on blank spots on the wall. And he's like, and Kevin's like, make sure you price some, you know. And, yeah, I was selling some. I was getting a couple of commissions off them. But the Comic Book Lounge eventually became, it's kind of like my second home, you know. It's no joke. I mean, a couple of times I actually fell asleep on the couch that they had there. Because I'd, like, be doing freelance work late, but I had to teach the kids in the morning. So Kevin's like, dude, we have a bathroom here. You can, you know, make sure you bring a toothbrush. I literally would fall asleep on the couch, and then early morning set an alarm, you know, go across the street to the cafe, grab breakfast, you know, teach the kids from like 8 until 11, and then you know, do the rest of the day as the employee of the lounge, which is great.
So you're just encompassed with the culture.
I was so encompassed. I was fully just entrenched in it.
Yeah.
Surrounded on all sides. It was just, you know,
Sounds like good times.
It was fantastic times. And that's actually where I met Shane initially, because he would come to the lounge and you know, pick up books and stuff. And he was friends, you know, we had like mutual friends. And one of the things that the lounge actually eventually started hosting was those comic book marathons, where there were like 12-hour comic book marathons, 24-hour comic book marathon. And so being a part of the comic lounge already, I'm like, why am I not going to be a part of this? So that's where initially I met Shane and Ricky and David Bishop and Sam Noir. And we'd all sort of like, we were all sort of acquainted with each other, mm-hmm. you know, like mm-hmm. because they would pop at different times of the shop and I was always there. So they'd come in, hang out and draw for a bit. But it wasn't until like the comic book marathon where there were at least 30 comic enthusiasts, creators who came together to see who could put together a full comic in a 24-hour period, 24 pages in 24 hours. And boy, man, I'd never participated in anything like that before. But being surrounded by so many other creators, you know, I mean, like, it just, it was the fire that just kept building.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I'm like, I didn't want this to end at all. Mm. And, you know,
great.
By the end of it, it was, it started 10 the previous morning and then ended, you know, the 10 on the Sunday morning. And by then, at the end, there were like 8 of us left, you know, who had actually made it through.
Made it through the marathon.
And I'd done this comic called, like, I think it was like Sad Robot or something. And it was just done. I drew it all with like Sharpie because I didn't have proper, like, super proper supplies at the time. But I loved it. And it was just me. It was one of my first real experiences drawing comics on the fly. Just got to think as you go. The writer, you were paired with a writer. Or you could do it yourself. And so I had a friend who was a writer who I had done the boot camp with. And he was like, okay, page one, da 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 da. And we were just both motoring through it. And I found that with every hour that passed, I was getting quicker doing a page. So by the end of it, I was almost getting 2 pages done in an hour.
Wow.
Right? But they weren't too big.
Yeah.
But the way I was drawing it was just like quick and dirty.
It's also a marathon,
stuff.
Right?
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
But I was really happy with how the story turned out. And I remember it was like 5 in the afternoon, I think, where we were like, okay, guys, take a break.
Hmm.
And so it was Shane, Dave Bishop, Ricky Lima, Sam Noir, and myself. We went around the corner to this like pizza place, and then somebody like took a picture. I think Dave Bishop has that up on his Facebook or something. I should have kept a copy of it, but it's just all of us sort of chilling out, you know, having pizza.
The early,
you
know? Days.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's a picture that I think really, I every time I see it, I'm like, you know, you'd want to relive it in your head constantly, you know. And
that's precious though.
Exactly.
Those memories are precious.
Exactly. And I think that it really, that year really sort of cemented, like, these are the people I need in my life, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean they're great friends, they're amazing creators, huge talents, you know. And you know, I mean, in being in that community, you've seen people break out and become big. You know,
yeah.
I remember when I was taking the boot camp course with Adam Gorham.
Wow.
And now Adam Gorham's, you know, he's working on New Mutants and Punk Mambo and stuff. And he does fantastic work. And I remember when I was in class with him, I'd sit beside him a couple of times. And he'd be like, I don't know if this is good enough. I'm like, are you kidding me? I mean, you're doing this stuff with your eyes closed. And it's such a unique, awesome, energetic style, you know, that he has. And he's only gotten better, you know. And just every time I see his work online, I'm like, I keep remembering sitting beside him in class, sort of thing. And he's
That's
just
great.
Like effortless, you know, doing these character sketches and stuff effortlessly. you know, but just being very, he's very down to earth, very humble.
Yeah.
Super, super,
super sweet guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So, you like seeing those guys win.
I do. I do. And what was also endearing was I saw him at this last Fan Expo with Greylight, and I bumped into him on the floor, just on the edge of Artist Alley, and he's like, "Hey, I need to get that book from you." And I honestly, with all the stuff that he's been doing, I didn't think that he would have known or remembered that I was working on a book. But mm-hmm. I'm like, I'm more than happy to give it to you. So I made sure at the end of the Fan Expo, at the end of the show, like day four, you know, we're all exhausted, we're all packing up to go, and I walk over to him and I just remember to give him, and he's like, "Oh man, thanks for giving me these books. You know, I really wanted to get them." And I'm like, "You have no worry about me getting your books, because, you know, I have them all." But yeah, I mean, all those guys, you know, have just been a huge, huge influence, and they're really good friends. And, you know, I mean, I feel super blessed that I've come into this situation after like all these years. Yeah, you often wonder, you're like, well, what would it be like, you know, to do comics or not succeed in comics? But I think it's not so much of like the way you succeed would be more like having fun and being, you know, that passion.
You loved doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's obviously stuck with me. And, you know, and I've just had the extreme fortune of connecting with all these creators in Toronto and even, you know, outside Ontario and even in the United States. A couple in the United Kingdom, actually.
That's cool.
But I just, you know... I'm very, very happy with where I am right now, you know? And, you know, one of the lucky spots was that, one of our, you know, friends and creators, Shane, have actually become a roommate with, you know? I'm like, who saw that coming?
Right.
You know?
Right,
it was just sort of like, I need to move out of my place. And Shane and I have been really good friends since, you know, like 2010 or what was it, 2011 or something? I can't remember. It was a while ago, quite a few years ago. And just that friendship has held strong enough that he would consider me to be like, you know what? You know, you want to be roommates? That'd be really cool. And it's honestly been a great living situation with
him. That's good.
You know? I mean...
Because that doesn't happen all the time.
It really doesn't. I mean, he's recounted horror stories of previous roommates and stuff. But, and so I went into it, I'm like, okay, I really hope I don't come off as one of those, you know, just really bad situations. And, you know... As you can see, things have worked out, I think, quite amicably.
Yeah. You know? Well, when I was prepping for this episode, he was one of the people I asked, like, what are some talking points and questions I could ask? And one of the first things he said was, he's a really good roommate. And yeah. I'm like, it's so nice to hear. Like, he had genuinely good things to say without there being any. It wasn't that you heard him.
Yeah,
it was exactly. Just genuine, yeah. Like you said.
I mean, amicable. No, it really is. I mean, it's like just there's no posing.
No,
or
none.
Fake. Like every day. I mean, I remember when we first set up here, and we would like just sit down. And the thing is that like before we even started being roommates, and even. I think it goes back to when we first were hanging at the lounge. He'd come into the lounge and we would sit down, and it wasn't like we'd sort of ache and pain through like small talk.
Right.
Be like, "Hey man, what are you working on?" "Oh, I'm working on this." "What are you working on?" "I'm just sketching." And we'd sit there for hours. We could sit there in total silence and just be totally cool drawing.
That's the best.
And, you know, and I think that sort of imprinted on both of us.
Yeah.
So every time we got together,
so peacefulness.
He was like, when he was here, he was like, "You know what? If you want to come over and draw and hang out and stuff," and he's done it with a lot of our friends as well. I would come over, you know, his roommate would be here sometimes and then other times not. And he would set up an 8-foot table. And again, we would just sit there and just do our thing, just chill. And sometimes, we'd, you know, trade funny stories or whatever. But it was just all about two creators, camaraderie, getting along, just drawing, doing what we love. And I think we both knew that we were just really in tune with wanting to be creating stories and doing comics and just loving, you know, and like getting bouncing ideas off each other and stuff. So
that's great for both of you, because I know he said to me, like, living with you helped him get his Morris done. Like, you were a big inspiration to him.
Well, which is funny because it's a vice versa thing, too, because his one quote to me, his only statement that just it hits me on the head every once in a while and keeps me going is, I'm like, man, I really wanted to work on this Grey Light book. And he just stared at me, just, you know, why are you not working on it? And I'm like, why am I not working on it? Mm-hmm. So, again, it's, you know, it's just, we just, all you have to do is sit there and do it.
Yeah.
You know, whether you succeed at it, whether you don't, you're still doing it. And I think he's been a huge, huge influence and support definitely through these last number of years.
That's you awesome.
Know? So, I mean, like, it's rubbed off. Like, I'll come home from work, you know, before he started working at Raid, and he'd just be sitting there just, like, firmly entrenched, got to get Morris done. And I'm like, you know what? Why am I not working on Grey Light?
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Sure.
And so he's working on Morris. I'm working on Grey Light. And the two of us just sitting there.
Inspiring each other.
Yeah. We'll put Howard Stern or whatever on in the background. And they just sit there and work for hours and hours until, like, you know, we just get tired or the dog has to go out or something, you know?
Right, right.
And then, but I think just, you know, he's one of the guys to being around, you know, It's a creative vibe that you get off, you know, and I think, you know, that's, you can't put a price on that.
No.
You can't, you know, it's immeasurable.
That's awesome.
So, yeah.
Tell me about Grey Light.
Well, Grey Light, it stemmed from, I think, the story idea is about a man who is gifted a power of interdimensional phasing from a group of aliens in the galaxy who were waging a war with this other, you know, this other race of aliens who's hell-bent on taking over planets in the solar system and galaxy. And, actually using their phasing power to erase it from existence. So they're, this one race comes to Earth, right? And what their decision is to gift one person in every city on the planet, kind of like a Green Lantern Corps thing, but without the outfits, with this power to phase through material space. And that's the only sort of like power match that they have against this, you know, alien aggressive race. And so the story follows this one this one character, Ordine, in this sort of just, it's a non-identified city. Like, I didn't really set it to be
it's in every city, right?
You know, it's got but it's contemporary, you
right.
know, skyscrapers, harbor fronts, you know, old automobiles and stuff like that, you know, and phones and stuff like that, just trying to, you know, be present day. But it follows him as he's showing him going throughout his day and talking in sort of internal monologue about, you know, I was gifted these powers. People still look at me funny even after all these years.
Was this inspired from like your X-Men
era? A part of it was inspired by the X-Men and, you know, that whole sort of, that whole aspect of being like a stranger and you know, but in being starting off as a normal part of society and then just, you know, and then changing with this, what, you know, changes the normal, you know, in his world.
And that's where the Green Lantern aspect where it's bestowed on you.
Exactly.
As opposed to like,
Because they're watching right, all these individuals and they're like, you're the guy we want.
Right.
And, the way I wrote it was I just jump into this city and jump and follow this guy around. And they're like, what's so special about this guy? And a couple of situations show up where you see his power, how he uses it. And then he's just sort of like, you know, telling you a bit of backstory, but not too much. Mm-hmm. And the story follows him as he sort of meets up with a fellow, you know, Graylighter, they call them, from another city, who comes to his city saying that, like, a couple of our group of us, they're starting to go missing, and I'm really scared because I don't know what to do. So she asks him for help, and he's reluctant because he's like, you know, man, it's not my pig, not my farm, not my war sort of thing. I'm just trying to deal with my thing. I don't know why you're here. But he eventually caves in because he's not a total jerk. He's like, you know what? I'll see what I can find out. So with these people who were bestowed this power, they each have a sort of segue representative to the regular, you know, human populace on the planet. So it's like their agent, right? Who is a segue between, you know, the alien race and, you know, the world, you know, just the world governments or city, you know, officials or whatever. Just being like a keeper of the peace, right? But they're also, you know, they keep them informed on everything that's going on, you know, with this whole new, because it's a whole new infrastructure with these people who could phase in and out of material space. It's not like someone who could fly. Mm-hmm. It's like one minute they're there, another minute they could like just totally disappear, but they're still there, you know, but you can't like, you know, it's not like they're just invisible. They're physically like intangible. You can't just, you know.
Where did the idea for the phasing power come from? Why that one?
Well, the thing was is that at the time I was dealing with a lot of I was doing freelance work out in Oakville, and I was doing a lot of commuting, and I am not a fan of huge crowds. I'm not a fan of like lots of angry people and rush hour and just this, you know, just this big hectic metropolitan life. And so one of my things was, you know what, I wish I could just sort of like disappear, but not totally, you know, like still be in the city, but just not a tangible part of it, you know, but just I could just move around
through it.
Yeah, you know, but still see the city. So the idea became that when this person phases, they can still see the city, but the city is represented kind of like, if you remember The Matrix, how Neo sees all the
numbers,
you know,
the code,
right? But it's not really code. It's just more sort of like small filaments of the tangible world, right? Just to sort of establish an environment for his, so he can still, you know, see
almost
where
like
he's
a sonar.
Going, right?
Yeah,
it's like sonar. Yeah. So a part of the influence was, you know, when they would show Daredevil's sort of sight, and I mean, I thought that was amazing. It's just like how they interpreted that. I'm like, this is really neat. So he's able to, you know, like fall into this interdimension, right? But he can still see the tangible world he's part of, but he can't interact with it unless he pushes himself out of phase, right? So it's a lot of concentration. So he, like, say if a car or something is about to hit him, right? He just has to focus. He'll move out of phase. Carl passed through him like a Kitty Pryde type thing, okay. Right? But the effect is sort of like different. It's like just all the strands, and then he can move back into phase when he's out of danger. A unique part of it that you see in the beginning of this story is that he can actually take things and take people and join them in his sort of phase shift.
Almost like Patrick Swayze in Ghost.
Exactly. You know, he's like moving the penny and stuff. Yeah. So, I didn't really do it so much like that. It was almost like he takes another individual and focuses enough, and that person's, you know, DNA is phased. You know, if he concentrates hard enough, he could actually, they'll be both part of this phase into the same space, right? So, you show a couple of instances of that, and like the issue just follows him as he just shows a couple of neat things he can do with his powers, but more so him starting on this, you know, on this adventure with this fellow Grey Lighter, you know, where he's like, I just wanted to do my day, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, I'll do superhero-ish stuff if I need to, but mm-hmm. I just want to keep it low-key,
right.
you know, because I already have enough people mad at me for being this weird magician,
right,
you
right,
know?
Right.
And, like, the way I wrote the character was that I didn't visually, embed myself in the character. I didn't draw him to look like me, you know? But I really felt like I wanted to, like, what would I like to be? You know, I mean, how would I like this power to work? And how would I move around the city if I had this power, sort of thing? So I found that interesting to sort of start to write a story arc where he's got this power, but all of a sudden there's this weird quirk where other people who have this power as well are going missing. It's a mystery, right?
Right. Right.
And at that time, I'm like still thinking back to the boot camp days, like Ty's sort of story act structure. You know, how do you start the story? What happens in the middle of the story? What is the result of that thing that happens, right? And I'm like, okay, I got to keep pace with this sort of thing. And so the story is following him as him and his new friend are trying to figure out why these other people with the gray light power going missing, and you're meeting the aliens, you know, who take on the human form as well. And you just follow their sort of journey. Like one part where I was having trouble doing storytelling was my first outing with Fonkin. I was focused too much on just like keeping the story on him all the time, every panel almost, right? So there was one thing that Ty pointed out to me. He's like, you know, every panel's about him. What about the challenges he's up against? There's no...
We're not seeing any perspective.
Exactly, no yeah. other perspective. So with Grey Light, I was trying to make sure that you got all these perspectives. You got his perspective. You got the person he met. Her perspective, you got the aliens' perspective, that sort of thing, and like the city, how they viewed, you know, this situation as well. So I've slowly, it's been more of taking my time with working out the story arc, but I feel it's, you know, it's moving along at a lot more smooth and confident pace than Fonkin was. Mm-hmm. So I can definitely see where this story is headed, you know, through having finished two issues of it and now working on a third, awesome. You know.
Yeah. So do you have an amount of issues that you plan on telling this story, or are you just going to let it flow and where it ends when you feel it's ready to end, it's going to end?
Well, it's not so much like ending, but like an arc, definitely. I would like to wrap up in like six issues at top. Each issue I've been doing is 12-page stories, and the way that I've been moving the story elements, the plot, you know, I'm being very careful not to stretch some things out too long or slingshot and cram all this stuff into one issue.
There is a good pace to it.
Yeah. So I just have to, I keep going back to issue one and issue two as I'm doing this third one. I'm like, okay, how did I pace this? Can I keep this going? You know? Because if I totally sort of forget that mindset and I just, you know, just blindly do the next issue, I know that it's not going to flow the same way, you know? So far, having done almost 6 pages of the third issue, I feel really confident that it's moving with the same, you know, the same tone and flow as the first 2 issues. Awesome. But definitely 6 issues. I think I would like to sort of wrap up this portion of the story. I could actually see it moving further or breaking off, you know, where another character sort of either takes on the mantle or a whole other sort of story just bursts out, you know, a whole other adventure
within the Grey Light universe.
Within the Grey Light universe, cool. Yeah. So, like, you know, spin-offs of some sort.
Yeah, you don't want to put yourself in that box where, mm-hmm. like, I got this story that I'm stuck having to tell now.
Exactly. But the tricky thing is because most comics are... standard comics out on the market are between, you know, like 24, 32 pages, sort of like as a standard. Me working in a 12-page format, I was worried that people would look and be like, that's it? That's pretty much like a freaking pamphlet, you know? But I've had good response from having premiered it at Fan Expo 2017. And all the way through to this past March Comic Con, where people have like looked at the book and had good response and be like, I'm really interested to see how where the story goes.
Yeah, me too.
So that's definitely, it's, you know, it's a confidence booster. It's, you know, but not so much of a really ego booster. It's just sort of like, okay, I'm doing things.
It's an inspiration booster.
It is.
It's like, I got a story that people want to know.
Exactly.
And they're enjoying it.
Yeah. So I'm doing something right. And I think the way that I'm doing it, because I'm not handcuffed to, I'm setting this deadline for myself. I'm working it at my own pace. Some days I'll do 3 or 4 panels on a page. Very, very, very rarely will I do an entire page of this comic, because I'm worried more about being very dedicated to putting as much, the best quality I can into each panel and each page as possible. So I'm switching gears, and some days I'll just do 1 panel and leave it at that. Like, I could do more. I could have so many more hours of the day. But you know what?
I'm going to concentrate. You felt good about that.
I'm going to focus on this panel and make it as good a, you know, storytelling element. Because going back to things like Bernie Wrightson and Jim Lee and these guys, one of the things that Joe Kubert told me was that every panel, even if it's like a open page sort of behind 3 panels, every panel has to be its own illustration. Like, absolutely. Can it just be a scritchety scratch just to sort of like, oh, here's an outline of a car or whatever? Every panel has to be treated as if you could cut it out, frame it, and put it on your wall. If you can't physically do that and have it look as its own sort of illustration, you're doing something wrong. So that's sort of the mindset that I've taken with this Grey Light book, is that every panel I have to treat with the utmost care, that tells the right story, that it looks as good as I can make it, you know, but not like, not totally break myself over producing it. So I think the pace that I'm working at the books and the care that I'm giving it, I think that I found my groove. But I know that, like, if through some divine intervention I happen to get working for a major publisher, I will have to sort of change it, you know, change it to their standards, which could very well be page a day, 2 pages a day, could be pencils and inks, whatever. But I think where my mindset is now is trying to evolve the style as much as I can, you know, and improve the quality of the, you know, the artwork and the storytelling.
It's coming along. It's coming along nice, and I'm looking forward to issue 3.
Yeah, I mean, I'd have to say I'm honestly looking forward to it too, because I sit there and look over the layouts and stuff, and I'm like, I really can't wait to get to this page. And
that's,
you know,
good.
And the fun thing is I know that I do layouts and prepare each page how it's going to look, but one of the fun aspects is changing things along the way. Like, if you're learning and finding better ways you can do things, you know, instead of just settling mm-hmm. on just like, I laid it out, I'm just going to do the page, whatever. Right. You know, just like stopping, like, and being like, better. whoa, I'm going to do this whole thing over. Like, I've done an entire page of pencils and then got back and erased the whole thing because, no, I could do that better. And I think that it comes from, like, not settling, but just like, learning from being inspired by others, from, you know, I mean, just being dedicated to the craft, right. I think, you know. So I'm hoping that it just keeps evolving from here on out.
Well, if you put the work in, you will.
Yeah.
You will, for sure. So before we wrap it up, I want to do a little game called Top 2. We usually do Top 5 episodes with Martin and Shane, but
right.
The question would be, if you're stranded on a desert island, food is plentiful, water is plentiful. You don't got to worry about that.
Okay.
So you don't got to, you know, I got to figure out a way to make fire. Nah, you got that stuff. What two items would you bring with you? But not just two. What two books would you bring with you?
Two books. I would have to say, one of them definitely, you probably know this already, would be that... that Batman...
Doesn't have to be a comic...
It doesn't have to be.
Two comic books is the next choice.
Oh, two comic books. Okay.
So here you got two prose books, novels.
One would be... there was a book by, I think, Robert Heinlein called Friday.
Okay.
And it was a story about this cybernetic woman or something trying to make her way in its like post-apocalyptic kind of Blade Runner type world, and I was just really fascinated by it. It was one of the only novels that I'd read cover to cover repeatedly, like for a month.
Wow.
Yeah, it was just like I read it, finished it,
gotcha,
went a couple of days, started reading it again, and then just had no problem reading it all the way through again. And it was one of the first novels that I wanted to actually visualize the way his Heinlein's writing was. And I was actually drawing little spot sketches of, like, certain scenes, you know, where she was interacting with certain characters or whatever. And I'm like, if a novel can affect me that much that I actually physically want to draw parts of the story, because I really want to see how they look, you know, I mean, that's you know, it's a book that really sticks with you. The other book, top two, the other book that I would have to say would be it was this it was a book from, it was like a novel from this collection of books that my dad had gotten years and years ago. You know, it's like collected short stories for kids or whatever.
Okay.
And it was just like really short sort of prose stories. They were like hardbound books or whatever. And there was one book about, like, you know, sort of spooky Halloween type stories, you know. And I didn't so much draw the pictures out of that one, but it was just like a book that just, like, every line I could sort of visualize, you know, like the scenery and, you know, and the characters and stuff. I forgot the name of it, though. God, I even forgot the name of the line of books that it came out with. Yeah, but it was just sort of like small story prose, kind of like a Robert Frost type thing, mm-hmm. like for kids or whatever. But it was like Halloween based or something, you know, really spooky. And now, like, I have a connection to the sort of Halloween, sort of spooky fall thing because I was born in the fall. And the running gag with me, with my family was that I always thought that Halloween was like my birthday party. You know, it's like, yeah, I have my birthday. And then a couple of days later, I get to dress up and go out and people just give me candy because it was my birthday.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Everyone's happy for it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so what two comic books would you pick?
The two comic books, obviously, one would be the Cult. Collection series by Bernie Wrightson. And then the other comic, I would have to say, would be the Alex Ross, Mark Waid Kingdom comic book.
Good choices.
Very, like, it. That was a really, really strongly written, you know, phenomenally drawn book. You know, I mean, it was just...
You get everything, and you get art, you get the story.
Yeah, and you just, like, I couldn't put it down.
Yeah.
Like, and I remember the first book that I got at 1 Million Comics on Young, then on Young. It was just, like, I saw the book, and I'm like, I didn't know that they had, like, the smaller issues, right, mm-hmm. before they had, like, the book one, book two, and I just saw book one, and I'm like, huh. That's cool. Superman looks like a real dude, kind of like Christopher Reeve did. Mm. And that was my first exposure to Alex Ross art. And I read it the same day. I remember I bought it. And then I went to a coffee shop. And I just sat down and I forgot how long I was sitting there. And I was just read it cover to cover. And I'm like, finished it. And I'm like, I wonder if 1 Million is still open because I want to go back and see if I can get the next one. And that was just like, you went in, the shop owner's like, dude, the next one will come out next month. Well, if you want to leave your number, we'll give you a call when it comes in. Like, I couldn't wait for the next one. And then the next one came out, boom. Yeah. I had to get it. Third one, fourth one. And I'm like, I'm really so happy that I have these, you know. Yeah. And it was another book that, like the Batman, the Cult book, I was just fully entrenched in. And they're just two of them that I could read endlessly.
Again, you know? Again.
Yeah, good absolutely.
Picks. Good picks. Yeah. What two albums?
Two albums. One would be... let's see here. Two albums that really, really stuck with me. One would be, honestly, Faith No More's Angel Dust. I don't know, it was high school. Faith No More was a sound that I hadn't really experienced before. And, like, between the singing and just, like, the beats and the bass and how they made, like, a sort of, like, metal but melodic operatic type thing was, like, amazing. The other album would probably be... I think The Smiths... The Queen is Dead.
Nice. Yeah. Love that album.
Yeah. It was a grade school album. You know, you're going through that sort of like prepubescent change. And you're feeling all these things. You're like emo. And I was. Yeah. I look back at pictures I saw that those 80s and my hair's doing this. And I'm surprised I didn't, you know, like just get down. And I started growing my hair out and. You know, and yeah, your brothers and sisters going, what are you, trying to be cool and all that? And you're like, shut up, you don't know anything.
So
Morrissey really speaks to me, you know?
The Smiths or The Cure?
I would have to say The Cure. Because something about Robert Smith, even when he wasn't like, you know, just sort of exuding that sort of like creepy Tim Burton-esque, but... poppy vibe at the same time. In interviews and stuff, he seemed like a really, really, really cool dude. Like, you'd want to sit down and have lunch with this dude. Whereas Morrissey, very standoffish, very, very all into himself. And sure enough, like, I mean, I've read recent articles about how he's such a difficult diva. You know, like his tour riders are ridiculous. Like, he would have, it was the one thing, like, he wouldn't go on at a venue unless the venue served nothing but vegan things. I've got nothing against vegans, right? But this stance where you're not gonna, you know,
right. You're gonna, unless you're like me.
Yeah.
Yeah, gotcha.
But out of the two, I'd much rather, you know, hang out and have lunch with Robert Smith, probably. Yeah.
Fair enough. And what two movies?
One of them definitely would have to be The Fifth Element.
Okay.
Just when I saw that movie, I was like blown away, you know. Just all the setting was very influential to me, you know. It was right in my headspace with, you know, Fonkin and Grey Light and stuff. The characters, I really cared about the characters. The way visually was just mind blowing, you know, how they pulled all that off. The other movie that I would have to say would be, this is going back, The Changeling with George C. Scott from 1970. Wow. There's a movie that, like, I remember seeing it as a wee child, scared the shit out of me. Oh, man, it's a movie that just stuck with me. Like, certain visuals, but also the minimal amount of dialogue in that movie, how it was all visual and all audio, right? Because the main character was like a musician and a music teacher and stuff. And, like, he depended a lot on, you know, just sound and how the sound sort of affected the environment. And then the minimal amount of dialogue in that movie, and it was all visual and audio and stuff. It was just a tremendously powerful, creepy vibe, you know? And it definitely hadn't shoulders above today's sort of like shock jump scare, really hard audio, you know. I mean, like, I haven't really gone to see many like horror movies of today, but there was someone had posted clips of The Changeling like on YouTube or something, and then it took me back. I'm like, this is real horror. Like films like The Exorcist and stuff, definitely scary. They had that same vibe too, where it was like, yeah, there were some visual, you know, horror elements to it, but there was a lot of psychological, you know, you're putting, they're really getting inside your head. And I felt like The Changeling did that to a T, and it's a movie that's really sort of stuck with me. You know, I could watch that thing like over and over.
Those are the ones you got to bring with you.
Absolutely.
Those are the ones.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Chris. This has been a blast.
Thank you very much.
Now that you've been on the show, you're going to be on again and again and again.
I certainly hope so. All right.
We're looking forward to Grey Light 3 or Issue 3. And what anything else that you're working on that you'd like to plug?
Well, I'm just currently trying to figure out whether I can sort of resuscitate the story of Fonkin. Like, it hasn't been totally buried yet, but I felt like it, through what I've learned over the past number of years, like, I feel like I need to sort of revisit it. But I don't really want to. I've sat down and started sort of doing light plot, you know, configuration of, like, say, a 3 or 4 story comic arc. But I haven't really stepped into it fully, because I want to realize this story arc with Grey Light first.
Yeah.
And I feel like if I try and divert and go into two stories at the same time,
they both might suffer.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So I'm going to, you know, I'm going to keep going strong with Grey Light and see it right to the story arc's finale. And then possibly I'll hopefully get back on track with Fonkin. If anyone, you know, knows me and knows of my co-creation Major North with Sam Noir, he's wanted to revisit that story as well. So he has sort of given me some script of the second issue of Major North. So there is, you know, there is a space in place to get Major North underway, Major North 2, rather, underway. So,
awesome. So yeah. You're gonna have a busy schedule creatively.
I will. That's, I mean, good. Unfortunately, I won't be at Fan Expo 2019. But that, I find that at the same time,
you won't have a table.
I won't have a table, but I will be there. Yeah. I will try my darndest to get there with my current work schedule. Because if nothing else, I just want to be. I always want to support fellow creators.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's one thing. Even if I'm there tabling, I always make sure I get up, walk around, get whatever new like creations they've made for the show, because I love seeing what they come up with. I love supporting them because they've been nothing but absolutely gracious and supportive of me. So, you know, I mean, that's how you sort of keep this community going.
Synergy.
Yeah,
comes
exactly.
All around. Right,
exactly.
Absolutely.
So.
Sounds good. Well, look forward to seeing you there.
All right.
All right. Thank you, Chris. We're going to do this again soon.
All right. Absolutely.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to this episode of The Cave of Solitude. Thank you again to Christopher Yao for hanging out with me and spending that time to talk comics, talk shop. And I hope everybody enjoyed it. It's been a while since we've been in the cave, and we're getting back on our feet now. So there'll be more episodes to come in the very near future. I already have one in the bag, ready to go with Martin and Shane Heron. So that'll be coming up soon. And of course, leave us a review at iTunes, or follow us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, Cave of Solitude, you will find us. And you can email us at caveofsolitude@outlook.com. So stay tuned for some more episodes coming up. I plan to have Adam Chapman back on from the Comic Shenanigans. I have a habit of calling him just by Chapman. Sorry, Adam, if you're listening. And there might be some solo episodes coming up as well, where I do my suggested reading list for anybody who's thinking about picking up some comics or trade paperbacks at their local comic shop. So once again, this is Eric Anthony signing off for The Cave of Solitude. Thank you again. Take care.